Welcome aboard, then. You can bring your things aboard any time today, and feel free to come and go as you please. The crew will need at least a day to rest here. I know you're eager to be down the river, but...
A day or even two will not disturb our plans, I replied. Our tasks will wait until we arrive.
But Paragon can't, so a day and a half is all I can give my crew this time, was Leftrin's observation. He shook his head at Elise. We'll be cutting it fine to meet Paragon and Treehog. Time and tides wait for no man, my dear, and both ships have schedules to keep.
I know, she said, but she smiled as she said it. He turned his smile at me.
The other ships make regular runs up and down the river, but neither of them rides the current as well as Tarman does when the water runs high in spring. Once the snow melts are done and the river calms, Tarman and his crew can take a nice break while the impervious boats take their turn. When the river runs swift with snow melt or the acid runs white in the main channel, we leave the pretty boats safely tied up, and Tarman shoulders the load.
He spoke with more pride than regret.
Are we going to be crowded with passengers going downriver?
Elise asked him, a bit anxiously.
No. I spoke to Harrikin. If any of the new folk can't abide the city's muttering, he'll send them across the river to village, to await our next run. I think he hopes that they'll settle and work there instead of fleeing back to whatever they came from.
He turned to me.
20 years of bringing folk here, and then taking half of them back when they can't cut it. It makes for a crowded ship and taking turns at the galley table. But this run will be only you folk, crew, and a bit of cargo. Should be a pleasant run if the weather stays fine.
The next morning was as clear and blue as a day could be. The wind off the river was ever present and never kind, but it was definitely spring now. I could smell the sticky new leaves unfolding and the dark earth waking. There were a few fresh scallions mixed in with the omelette and fried potatoes at the breakfast we shared with the keepers who had gathered to say farewell. Sylvie told us jubilantly that the chickens she had insisted on keeping in the garden houses over the winter were now laying reliably again. The farewell gathering included the children and companions of the keepers. Many came to thank me again and offer parting gifts. A pragmatic man named Carson had brought us dried strips of meat in a leather pouch.
It will keep you if you don't let damp get to it.
I thanked him and had that instant sense of connection that sometimes comes. A feeling of a deep friendship that could have been. Amber and Spark both received earrings from a woman named Jerd.
There's nothing magical about them, but they're pretty, and in a hard time, you could sell them.
She had given birth to a little girl I had healed, but oddly enough, an elderling named Cedric was raising the child with Carson.
I am fond of the girl, but was never meant to be a mother,
Jerd informed us cheerily. The little girl, sitting on Cedric's shoulders and gripping his hair in two tight handfuls, appeared content with her lot. Cedric was enthusiastic about her. She has begun to make sounds. She turns her head when we speak now. The child's mass of coppery hair concealed her very tiny ears.
And Relpda now understands the problem and will help us with it. Our dragons are not cruel, but they do not always understand how a small human is meant to grow.
And from the Queen of the Elderlings, a box that held assorted teas. She smiled as she offered it to Amber.
A small pleasure can be a great comfort when one travels, she said, and Amber accepted it gratefully.
It was noon before we processed down to the ship. Our baggage was already stowed on board, and our new gifts filled a barrow that Perseverance pushed. Tats had given an elderling scarf to Purr, and he had folded it very carefully and asked quietly if he might send it to his mother from Bingtown. I assured him we could. Timara had pulled Amber aside to present her with a woven bag. I overheard her giving her yet more cautioning words about the silver on her fingers. The farewells at the dock seemed to take forever, but Leftrin finally gave a shout and said it was time we were away if we were to have any daylight at all. I watched Alum kiss his girl, who then hurried aboard and took charge of the deck crew. Leftrin observed me watching them.
Skelly's my niece. She'll Captain Tarman some day, after I lie down on his deck and slide my memories into his timbers.
I raised my brows. Captain Leftrin hesitated, then laughed at himself.
Liveship ways are not as secret as they once were. Liveships and their families are very close. Children are born aboard the family ship, and grow to crew and then captain. When they die, the ship absorbs their memories. Our ancestors live on in our ships. He gave me an odd grin. A strange immortality.
Rather like putting memories into a stone dragon, I thought to myself. A strange immortality, indeed. He gave his grizzled head a shake, and then invited us to join him and Elise in the galley for coffee, while the crew went about its tasks.
"Don't you need to be on the deck?"
Perseverance asked him, and Captain Leftrin grinned.
"If I can't trust Skelly by now, I should just cut my throat today. My crew loves the ship, and Tarman loves them. There's little they can't handle, and I enjoy my time with my lady."
We found cramped seats around the scarred galley table. The small room was crowded in a friendly way, redolent of the year's cooking and wet wool. The coffee added its own fragrance. I'd had the stuff once before and knew what to expect, but I watched Purr pucker his mouth in surprise.
"Oh, here, lad, you've no need to drink that. I can make a pot of tea just as easily."
And with a swoop, Elise took his mug, dumped the contents back into the coffee pot, and began to dip a water into a battered copper kettle. The little iron stove warmed the room almost unbearably, and she soon had the kettle hissing on top of it. I looked at us, seated so companionably around the table. At Buckkeep Castle, Spark and Purr would have been dismissed to a servant's table, and perhaps Lant and I would have dined separately from a humble ship's captain and his lady. The room gave a dip and a lurch. Purr's eyes went wide, and Spark audibly caught her breath. The greedy current rushed us out onto the river. I craned to look out of the small window. I saw only grey river water. Leftrin sighed with satisfaction.
"Aye, we're well on our way now. I'll just step out and see if Big Ida needs a hand with the tiller. He's a good man, if simple. Knows the river well, but we're still missing Sworge. 30 years that man kept us steady in the current. Well, he's gone into Tarman now."
"As we all will, eventually,"
Elise affirmed with a smile.
"I must step out also. I need to ask Skelly where she stored the last barrel of sugar."
She looked at Spark.
"I'll count on you to brew the tea when the water boils. It's in the box on the shelf by the window."
"Thank you, Lady Elise. I shall do so."
"Oh, Lady Elise!"
Her cheeks went pink and she laughed.
"I haven't been a lady for years. I'm just Elise. If I forget to address you as the grand folk you are, you'll have to excuse me. I'm afraid my Bingtown manners have faded after nearly a score of years on the river."
We laughed and all assured her that we were comfortable. And we were. I felt more at ease on Tarman than I had in the Dragon City. The opened door let in a gust of river wind and then slammed shut behind her. We were left to ourselves, and I heard Amber breathe a soft sigh of relief.
"Do you think they'd mind if I went on deck and had a look about?"
Purr asked wistfully.
"I'd like to see how the tiller works."
"Go," I said. "They'll tell you if you're in the way, and if they tell you to move, do it fast. It's more likely they'll find some work for you to do." Lant unfolded himself as the boy stood.
"I'll keep an eye on him. I'd like to have a look about myself. I've been out fishing with friends on Buckkeep Bay, but never on a river, let alone one so large and swift."
"Will you still want tea?"
Spark asked them, for the kettle had begun to steam.
"Most likely. I think it's pretty cold out there, with the wind and all."
And again the wind slammed the door as they left.
"What an odd little family we've become,"
Amber observed as Spark took down a lovely sea-green pot for the tea. She smiled and added,
"No tea for me. I'm content with the coffee. It's been years since I've had good coffee."
"If this is good coffee, I dread what bad coffee might be," I told her. I did as I'd seen Elise do, dumping my unwanted cupful back into the big black pot on the stove. I waited for the tea to brew. We settled easily into life aboard ship and found a new rhythm to our days. The crew was happy to take Perseverance in and give him small tasks. When our lad was not learning his knots from Belin, a large and near-silent woman who could manage a deck pole as well as any man, he was put to polishing, sanding, oiling, and cleaning. He took to it as a duck to water, and told me one afternoon that if he were not sworn to me, he could be happy as a ship's boy. I felt a twinge of jealousy, but also relief to see him busy and happy. Motley had joined us as soon as Tarman cast off from Kelsingra. The crow got over her wariness quickly and shocked all of us by preferring a perch on the bow rail. The first time she squawked, "Tarman! Tarman!" she won the heart of the crew and made Perseverance beam with pride. She became a cheery presence on the boat if the weather was blustery. She happily rowed on Purr as he went about his tasks, but whenever Lady Amber emerged onto the deck, Motley transferred to her. The crow had learned to chuckle and had an uncanny ability to laugh at just the right moment. Her gift for mimicry had become suspiciously good, but whenever I reached toward her with the wit, I found only the bland fog of a creature who was proudly uninterested in forming a bond. "How much do you understand?" I demanded of her one afternoon. She cocked her head at me, met my gaze, and demanded, "How much do you understand?" With a chuckle, she took flight downriver ahead of Tarman. Travel aboard a vessel is either boring or terrifying. On Tarman, I was glad to be bored. The farther away from the city, the less the skill current pressed on my walls. Each night, the tillerman steered us into moorage along the riverbank. Sometimes there was a beach, and we could disembark, but often we were nudged up against a bank of trees with serpentine roots. On the third day, the river narrowed and deepened and the current became much stronger. The forest closed in and there was no true horizon. The banks of the river were solid walls of trees with stilt roots, and we moored to them at night. It began to rain and didn't stop. Motley moved into the galley. I moved between our cramped cabin and the ship's steamy galley. My clothing and bedding were always slightly damp. I tried to pass my time constructively. Amber suggested I learn Mersin, the old language of Clerys.
"Most people will speak common to you, but it's useful to know what they say to one another when they think you can't understand them."
To my surprise, my companions joined in. In the long, wet days, all of us would hunch on the cramped bunks while Amber would drill us in vocabulary and grammar. I had always been adept at learning languages, but Perseverance outshone me. Lant and Spark struggled, but we pressed on. I put Lant to helping Perseverance with his letters and numbers. Neither of them relished those tasks, but they made progress. In the evenings, after we were moored, Lant, Spark, and Perseverance would join the crew in games that involved dice, cards, and some little carved rods. Imaginary fortunes changed hands often across the table. While they gamed, Amber and I convened in her cabin. I valiantly ignored the small smiles that Leftrin and Elise would exchange when I rejoined the company. I wished I could find humor in them, but in truth, I felt as if I tormented the fool during our private sessions. He wanted to help, but the viciousness he had endured at Clara's made it hard for him to speak his memories in a coherent order. The scalding anecdotes I pried from him only made me reluctant to dig deeper, and yet I knew I must. I learned of the four in bits and references. It was the best he could offer me. The only one of the four I learned about in detail was Capra. Capra seemed to take pride in being the eldest of the four. She had long, silver hair and wore blue robes weighted with pearls. She appeared gentle, kind, and wise. She had been his mentor when he had first arrived at Clara's. In his early days there, he was invited daily to her tower room after he had completed his lessons. There they would sit together on the floor before her fire while he scribed his dreams onto thick, soft paper that was as yellow as a daisy's heart. They shared delicious little cakes, exotic fruits and cheeses. She taught him about wines with tiny sips from little gold-rimmed goblets and educated him on teas. Sometimes she invited tumblers and jugglers there, simply to entertain him, and when he wished to join in, she had them teach him their skills. She praised him, and he blossomed in her care. When she spoke his name, Beloved, he believed she meant it. He spoke of an adolescence I envied, pampered, praised, educated, any child's dream. But we all wake from dreams. Most often, I sat on the floor of our cabin, and he claimed a lower bunk and stared sightlessly up as he spoke. Rain spattered on the small windows of the cabin. A single candle he could not see gave me a dim light appropriate to his dark tales. He was the fool in those sessions, in a loose blouse with a spill of lace down his chest and plain black leggings, amber's gown, a wilted flower on the cabin's floor. His posture and garments were similar to when we had been youngsters, knees drawn up to his chin, one bared hand and one gloved hand clasped around his knees. His unseeing eyes stared at a distant time.
I studied hard to please her. She gave me dreams to read and listened to my earnest interpretation. I was sitting before her fire when I first read of the unexpected sun in an old and crumbling scroll. It spoke to me as no other had. I literally began to tremble. My voice shook as I told her of a childhood dream. My dream and the old one fit together like interlaced fingers. I spoke true to her, saying I'd be sorry to leave her, but I was the White Prophet for this time. I knew that I needed to be out in the world, preparing for the changes I must make. Fool I was indeed, fearing I would hurt her by leaving.
The fool made a small sound.
She listened to me. Then she shook her head sadly and gently said, "You are mistaken. The White Prophet for this time has already manifested. We have trained her, and soon she will begin her tasks. Beloved, every young white wishes to be the White Prophet. Every student at Clarice has made that claim. Do not be sad. There are other tasks for you, to do humbly and well to aid the true White Prophet." I could not believe what I was hearing. My ears rang, and my vision swam to hear her deny me. But she was so wise and kind and old, I knew she must be right. I tried to accept that I was wrong, but my dreams would not let me. From the time she denied me, my dreams came on like a storm, two and three a night. I knew as I wrote them down that she would be displeased, but I could not hold them back. She took each one and showed me how it did not apply to me, but to another.
He shook his head slowly.
Fitz, I cannot explain my distress. It was like looking through badly made glass, eating rotten meat. There was a foulness to her words that made me feel physically ill. They ran wrong in my ears. But she was my mentor. She treated me so lovingly. How could she not be right?
He asked that question so earnestly. His hands, gloved and bared, needed each other. He looked away from me as if I could read anything in his shuttered eyes.
One day, she took me up the steps to the top tower room. Fitz, it was huge, bigger than the Queen's Garden at Buckkeep Castle, and it was littered with treasures, amazing things, objects that were lovely beyond imagining, scattered like discarded toys. There was a staff that gleamed with light all along its length, and a marvelous throne made from tiny interlocking flowers of jade. Some I know now were of elderling make. Wind chimes that sang, a statue of a pot with a plant that grew from it, flowered, faded back into the soil and then grew again. I gazed in wonder, but she told me crisply that they came from a faraway beach where such treasures washed up, and that the stewards of that place had bargained with her that all the sea gave them would be hers if she granted them a boon. I wanted to know more of that story, but she took my hand and drew me to the window and bade me look down. I saw a young woman below in a walled garden full of flowers and vines and fruit trees. She was white as I was white. I had met others at Clarice who were almost as colorless as I was. Almost. They had all been born there, and they all seemed to be related, sister to brother, cousin and uncle. But none of them were white as I was white. Not until I saw her. Another woman was there, with red hair and a great sword. She was teaching the pale woman how to wield it as a serving maid watched and cried encouragement. The white woman danced with that sword, and her hair floated as she moved so beautifully. Then Capra said, "There she is, the true white prophet. Her training is almost complete. You have seen her. Let us have no more of foolishness."
He shuddered.
That was the first time I saw the pale woman.
He fell silent. "You have told me enough for tonight." He shook his head, his mouth pursed tight shut. He lifted his hands and rubbed his face hard, and for a moment the faded scars stood out against his skin.
"So I didn't speak of my destiny again,"
he said harshly.
"I wrote down my dreams, but I no longer tried to interpret them. She took them from me and set them aside. Unread, I believed."
He shook his head.
"I have no idea how much knowledge I handed over to her. By day I studied, and I tried to be content. I had a lovely life, Fitz. All that I could ask for. Good food, attentive servants, music and amusements in the evening. I was useful, I thought, for Capra put me to sorting old scrolls. It was a clerk's work, but I was good at it."
He kneaded his scarred hands together.
"In the way of my kind, I was still a child. I wanted to please. I missed being loved. So I tried. But of course, I failed. In my clerk's work, I encountered writings about the unexpected sun. I had a dream of a jester singing a silly song about fat suffices. He sang it to a wolf cub, Fitz. The cub had sprouting antlers."
He gave a muffled laugh, but the hair stood up on my arms. Had he truly seen me in a dream, so many years before we had even met? But it had not been me. It had only been a puzzle to which I was, perhaps, the answer.
"Oh, I do not like this tale I vomit out to you. I wish I had not begun telling it. So many things we have never spoken about. So many things that shame me less if I am the only one who knows them. But I will finish."
He looked toward me, his sightless eyes swimming with tears. I slid across the floor and took his gloved hand in mine. His smile was a wavering thing.
"I could not forever deny what I was. My anger and resentment grew. I wrote my dreams down, and I began to reference other dreams, some ancient, some recent. I built a fortress of evidence that Capra could not deny. I did not insist I was the white prophet, but I began to ask her questions, and they were not innocent ones."
He smiled slightly.
"I know you could never guess it, Fitz, but I can be stubborn. I was determined to force her to admit who and what I was."
Again he paused. I did not speak. This was like digging splinters out of an infected wound. He pulled his hand from mine and wrapped his arms around himself as if freezing.
"I'd never been so much as slapped by my parents, Fitz. Not that I was a tractable and easy child. No, I am sure I was not. Yet they had corrected me patiently, and I had come to expect that from adults. Never had they denied me information as to why a thing was so. Always they had listened to me, and when I taught them something new, they were always so proud of me. I thought I was clever to ask Capra questions about my dreams and other dreams I had read. My questions would lead her to the inevitable answer that I was, indeed, the white prophet. And so I began, a few questions on one day, a few more the next. But the day I asked Capra 6 questions in a row, all leading up to what she must admit about me, she held up her hand and said, "Not another question. I will tell you what your life is to be." Not even thinking, being young as one is only once, I said, "But why?" And that was it. Without a word, she rose and pulled a bell pull. A servant came, and she sent him for someone else, a name I did not know then. Kester. A very large and muscular man, and he came and held me down with a foot on the back of my neck and let his leather strap fall wherever it would on my body. I screamed and begged, but neither of them spoke a word. As abruptly as it began, my punishment was over. She dismissed Kester, seated herself at her table and poured some tea. When I could, I crawled from her room. I remember my long trip down the stone stairs of her tower. The lash had fallen on the big muscles behind my knees and curled around one of my ankles. The tip of it had etched into my belly more than once. It was agony to try to stand. I edged down on my hands and knees, trying not to pull on the welts, crept to my cottage and stayed there for 2 days. No one came. No one asked after me or brought me water or food. I waited, thinking someone would come. No.
He shook his head, old bafflement on his face.
Capra never summoned me again. She never spoke directly to me again.
He sighed out a small breath. In the silence that followed, I asked, "What were you expected to learn from that?" His tears scattered as he shook his head.
"I never knew. No one ever spoke of what she had done to me. When 2 days had passed, I limped to the healer's room and waited for the full day. Others came and went, but he never summoned me. No one, not even the other students, asked what had happened. It was as if it had never occurred in their world, only mine. Eventually I began to limp to my lessons and to meals. But my instructors had a new disdain for me, rebuked me for my missed lessons, and punished me by withholding food. I was made to sit at the table and work on lessons while the others ate. It was on one of those days that I saw the pale woman again. She walked through the hall where we gathered for meals. All the other students looked at her with admiring eyes. She was garbed all in green and brown, like a hunter, and her white hair was braided back with golden thread. So beautiful. Her servant followed her. I think, looking back, I think her servant was Dwalia, the one who took B. One of the people who prepared our food hurried out and gave a hamper to Dwalia. Then the pale woman walked out of the hall with her servant carrying the basket. As she passed me, she halted. She smiled at me, Fitz. Smiled, as if we were friends. Then she said, 'I am, and you are not.' And she walked on, and everyone laughed. The twist to my mind and thoughts were worse than the welts all over my body."
He needed his silence for a time, and I let him keep it.
"So clever they are,"
he said at last.
"The pain they gave my body was only a gateway to what they could do to my mind. Capra must die, Fitz. The four must die to end the corruption of the whites."
I felt ill. Her servant was Dwalia, the same Dwalia that stole B.
"So I think. I could be wrong."
A question I didn't want to ask, an unwise question, found its way to my voice. "But after all that and all else you have told me, you went back with Prilcop?" He laughed bitterly.
"Fitz, I was not myself. You had brought me back from the dead, Prilkop was strong and calm. He was so certain that he could restore Clarys to its proper service. He came from a time when the word of a white prophet was a command to the servants. He was so certain of what we should do, and I had no idea what to do with this unexpected life.
I recall a similar time in my life. Burrick made all our decisions.
Then you understand. I couldn't think about anything. I just followed what he said we were going to do.
He clenched his teeth and then said,
Now I go back for a third time. And more than anything, I fear that I will fall into their power again.
He took a sudden, gulping breath, but even so he could not seem to catch his breath. He began gasping like a spent runner. He could barely get his words out.
Nothing could be worse than that. Nothing.
Hugging himself, he rocked back and forth on the bunk.
But I must go back. I must.
He snapped his head back and forth wildly.
Need to see,
he cried out suddenly.
Fitz, where are you?
His gasping was even faster.
Can't feel my hands.
I knelt beside the bed and put an arm around him. He yelped and struggled wildly, striking out at me. It's me. You're safe. You're here. Breathe, fool. Breathe. I refused to let go. I was not rough, but I held him firmly. Breathe.
I can't.
Breathe, or you'll faint. But you can do that. I'm here. You are safe. Suddenly he went limp and stopped fighting me, and very gradually his breathing slowed. When he pushed me away, I let him. He folded himself tight and hugged his knees. When he finally spoke, he was ashamed.
I never wanted you to know how much I feared to do this. Fitz, I'm a coward. I'd rather die than let them take me.
You don't have to go back. I can do this.
I do have to go back.
He was instantly furious with me.
I must!
I spoke quietly. Then you will. With great reluctance, I added, I could give you something to carry with you. A quick end if you thought you would prefer that. His gaze wandered over my face as if he could see me. He said quietly,
You'd do it, but you'd not approve, nor have such a resource for yourself.
I nodded, then spoke. That's true.
Why?
Something I overheard a long time ago. It didn't make sense when I was younger, but the older I get, the wiser it seems. Prince Regal was speaking to Verity.
And you put weight on something Regal said? Regal wanted you dead. From the moment he knew of your existence, he wanted you dead.
True, but he was quoting what King Shrewd said to him. Probably the king's response when Regal suggested that killing me was the easiest solution. My grandfather told him, Never do what you can't undo until you've considered well what you can't do once you've done it. A slow, fond smile claimed his face.
Ah, that does sound like something my king would have said.
His smile widened, and I sensed a secret he would not share. Killing myself would put an end to all other possibilities, and more than once in my life, when I thought death was my only escape, or that it was inevitable and I should surrender to it, I've been proven wrong. And each time, despite whatever fire I had to pass through, I found good in my life afterward.
Even now, with Molly and Bea dead?
It felt disloyal, but I said it. Even now. Even when I feel like most of me is dead, life breaks through sometimes. Food tastes good, or something Purr says makes me laugh. A hot cup of tea when I'm cold and wet. I've thought of ending my life, fool, I admit it, but always, no matter the damage to it, the body tries to go on, and if it manages to, then the mind follows it. Eventually, no matter how I try to deny it, there are bits of my life that are still sweet. A conversation with an old friend. things I am still glad to have. He groped for me with his gloved hand, and I offered mine. He shifted his grip to a warrior's clasp, wrist to wrist. I returned the pressure.
It's true for me as well, and you are right. I would never have thought to admit it, even to myself.
He released my wrist and leaned back, then added,
But still, I would take your escape if you will prepare it for me, because if they do manage to take me, then I cannot.
His voice had begun to shake. I can prepare something for you, something you could carry tucked in the cuff of your shirt.
That would be good. Thank you.
Of such cheerful discourse were my evenings made. I had not realized that we were on a tributary until we left it and joined the furious rush of the rain-wild river. The turbulent waters that carried us now were grey with acid and silt. We no longer drew water from the river, but relied only on our casks. Belin warned Perseverance that if he fell overboard,
All we might pull back would be your bones!
It did not dampen his enthusiasm at all. He scampered about the deck despite the rain and wind, and the crew tolerated him with good humour. Spark had less endurance for the foul weather, but she and Lant would sometimes stand on top of the deckhouse, sheltering under a square of tarpaulin, and watch the passing view as the current swept us along. I wondered what fascinated them, for the scenery had become unvarying. Trees. More trees, some of a size I had never imagined, with trunks as big around as towers. Trees made of 100 spindly trunks, trees that leaned and dropped extra trunks down from the branches into the river's marshy edge. Trees with vines climbing up them, trees with curtains of vines dangling down. I had never seen forest so thick and impenetrable, or foliage that could survive such wet conditions. The far shore of the river retreated to a foggy distance. We heard more birds during the day, and once saw a shrieking troop of monkeys. Very strange to me. It was all so different from the familiar landscapes of Buck. Even as it fascinated me and I longed to explore it, my deeper longing was for home. My thoughts went often to my nettle, gravid with her first child. I'd abandoned her when she was still growing within Molly to obey the urgent summons of my king, and now I left her to bear my first grandchild alone at the behest of the fool. How did Shade fare? Had he succumbed to age and a wandering mind? There were times when taking vengeance for the dead seemed too high a price for abandoning the living. I kept such musings to myself. My fears of Skilling lingered. The press of it I had felt in Kelsingrar had diminished, but the living ship beneath my feet was a constant hum of sentience against my walls. Soon, I promised myself, even a brief skill contact could convey so much more than the tiny lettering on a messenger bird's scroll. Soon. Once, when we were moored for the night, Skelly rose from the table, retrieved a bow and quiver from the crew quarters, and then stepped soundlessly onto the deck. No one moved until we heard her shout,
I got a river pig! Fresh pork!
There was a scramble to the deck, and the messy, exuberant work of retrieving the dead animal. We butchered him on the narrow mud beach. We feasted that evening. The crew built a fire, threw on green branches, and toasted strips of pig in the flames and smoke. The fresh meat put the crew in a merry mood, and Perseverance was pleased to be teased as one of their own. After we had eaten, the cook fire became a bonfire that drove back the darkness and the biting night insects. Lant went for firewood and returned with an armful of an early-blooming vine with fragrant flowers. Spark filled Amber's hands with some, and then crowned herself with a garland. Hennessy began a bawdy song, and the crew joined in. I smiled and tried to pretend I was neither an assassin nor a father mourning the loss of his child. But to join their simple, rowdy pleasure seemed a betrayal of Bee and how her little life had ended. When Amber said she was wearied, I assured Spark that she should stay with Lant and Purr and enjoy the evening. I guided Amber as we moved over the mucky shoreline to a rough rope ladder tossed over Tarman's side. It was a struggle for her to climb the sagging rungs in the long skirts she wore. Would not it all be easier if you dropped the pretense of Amber? She gained the deck and tousled her skirts back to order.
"And which pretense would I then assume?"
she asked me. As always, such words gave me a twinge of pain. Was the fool indeed only another pretense, an imaginary companion invented for me? As if he had heard my thoughts, he said,
"You know more of me than anyone, Fitz. I've given you as much of my true self as I dare."
"Come," I said, and took his arm for balance while we both shed our muddy footwear. Captain Leftrin was rightfully fussy about keeping the deck clean. I shook the mud from our shoes over the side and carried them as I guided him back to the cabin. From the shore came a sudden whoop of laughter. A whirl of sparks rose into the night as someone threw a heavy piece of wood onto the bonfire.
"It is good for them to have some enjoyment."
"It is," I replied. Childhood had been stolen from both Spark and Perseverance. Even Lant could use a window of merriment in his permanent wall of melancholy. I went to the galley to kindle a little lantern. When I returned to the cabin, the fool was already out of Amber's fussy dress and into his simpler garb. He had wiped the paint that composed her face onto a cloth and turned to me with his old fool's smile. But in the light of my small lantern, the tracks of his torment still showed on his face and hands as silver threads against his light skin. His fingernails had regrown thick and stubby. My efforts at healing and the dragon's blood he had taken had aided his body's recovery more than I had dared hope, but he would never be who he had been. But that was true of all of us.
"What are you sighing about?"
"I'm thinking of how this has changed all our lives. I was on the way to being a good father, fool, I think. Yes, burning bodies of murdered messengers at night. Excellent experience for a growing child."
"Yes, well."
He sat down on the lower bunk. The upper bunk was neatly spread up. The other two bunks seemed to be serving as storage for the excessive wardrobe that he and Spark had dragged with them. He sighed and then admitted,
"I had more dreams."
"Oh?"
"Significant dreams. Dreams that demand to be told aloud or written down."
I waited. "And?"
"It is hard to describe the pressure one feels to share significant dreams."
I tried to be perceptive. "Do you want to tell them to me? Perhaps Leftrin or Elise would have pen and ink and paper. I could write them down for you."
"No!"
He covered his mouth for a moment, as if the explosive denial had revealed something.
"I told them to Spark. She was here when I woke in a terrible state, and I told her."
"About the Destroyer?" He was silent for a moment. Then,
"Yes, about the Destroyer."
"You feel guilty about that?" He nodded.
"It's a terrible burden to put on one so young. She already does so much for me."
"Fool, I don't think you need be concerned. She knows that I am the Destroyer, that we are on our way to bring down all Clarys. Your dream just repeats what we all know." He wiped the palms of his hands down his thighs and then clasped them together.
"What we all know,"
he repeated dully.
"Yes."
Abruptly he added,
"Good night, Fitz. I think I need to sleep."
"Good night, then. I hope your dreams are peaceful."
"I hope I don't dream at all," he replied.
It felt strange to rise and leave him there, taking the lantern with me, leaving the fool in the dark, as he was always in darkness now. Chapter 10. Bee's Book. The preparation of the darts must be done with a steady hand. One cannot wear gloves, but one must be extremely cautious, for the smallest nick of the fingers will become infected immediately, and the parasites will quickly spread. There is no cure. I have found that using the eggs of the boring worms combined with the eggs of the ones that cling inside a man's guts and become long worms is the most effective in causing a prolonged and painful death. Eggs from one or the other will plague the victim, but not lead to death. It is the double attacks of these creatures that inflict the death most befitting the cowards and traitors who dare betray Clarys. Various devices of my own design. Kultri of the Four. After a few days aboard Tarman, I had grown more accustomed to the light press of the ship's awareness against mine. I was still uncomfortable that a live ship would be privy to any message I might skill out, but after much debate with myself, I had decided to risk the contact with home. Lady Amber sat down on the ship's bunk opposite mine. A cup of tea steamed on the little shelf by the bunk. In the small space, our knees nearly touched. She gave a sigh, untwined a scarf from her damp hair, and shook it out. Then the fool reached up to tousle his hair into wild disorder that it might dry more quickly. It was no longer the dandelion fluff of his boyhood, or as golden as the Lord Golden's hair had been. To my surprise, white mixed with the pale blonde of it, like an old man's hair. White hair growing from the scars on his scalp. He wiped his fingers on Amber's skirts and gave me a weary smile. "Are you ready?" I asked him.
"Ready and well supplied,"
he assured me. "How will you know if I need your help? What will you do if I am swept away?"
"If I speak to you and you don't respond, I'll shake you. If you still don't respond, I'll dash my tea in your face."
I hadn't realized that was why you'd ask Spark for tea.
"It wasn't."
He took a sip from his cup.
"Not entirely."
"And if that doesn't bring me back?" He groped on the bunk beside him and held up a small pouch.
"Elf bark. Courtesy of Lant. It's well powdered to mix with my tea and pour down your throat or simply stuff into your mouth."
He canted his head.
"If the elf bark fails, I will link my fingers to your wrist, but I assure you that will be my final resort."
"What if you do, and instead of you pulling me back, I drag you under?"
"What if Tarman hits the rock and we all drown in the acid waters of the Rainwild River?"
I stared at him in silence.
"Fitz, get to it, or don't, but stop procrastinating. We are far from Kelsingra. Try to skill."
I centered myself and let my vision unfocus, evened my breathing, and slowly lowered my walls. I felt the sweep of the skill current, as cold and powerful as the river beneath our hull, just as dangerous. It was not the riptide it had been in Kelsingra, but I knew that it concealed hidden currents. I hesitated upon the brink, and then waded in, groping for Nettle. I did not find her. I reached for Thick. A distant wailing of music might have been him, but it faded as if wind had blown it away. Dutiful? Not there. I tried for Nettle again. I felt as if my fingers brushed my daughter's face and slid away. Shade? No. I had no desire to tatter away in the skill current alongside my old mentor. When last I had seen the old man, his moments of acuity had been brief islands in a sea of vagueness. His skill magic, once so feeble, now sometimes roared, and he used it without caution. The last time we had connected in the skill, he had nearly dragged me away with him. I must not try to reach for Shade. Shade seized me. It was like being grappled from behind by a boisterous playmate, and I was flung headlong into a wild rush of skill.
"Oh, my boy, there you are. I've missed you so."
His thoughts embraced me in a tightening net of fondness. I felt myself becoming the person that Shade imagined me to be. Like clay pressed into a brick mold, the parts of me he'd never known were being sheared away.
"Stop! Let me go! I have word for Dutiful and Nettle, news of Kelsingra and the dragon traders."
He chuckled warmly, yet I felt chilled at the soft press of his thoughts.
"Leave that! Leave all that and join us here! There is no loneliness, no separation at all, no aching bones, no worn-out body.
It's not what they told us, Fitz. All those warnings and dire predictions. Fuh! The world will go on without us just as well as it did with us. Just let go.
Was it true? His words were soaked in conviction. I relaxed in his grip as the skill current roared past us.
We aren't tattering. I'm holding you tight, keeping you part of me. It's like learning to swim. You can't find out how until you're all the way into the water. Stop clinging to the bank, boy. You only tear apart when you try to hold on to the shore.
He had always been wiser than me. Shade had always advised me, educated me, and commanded me. He seemed calm and content. Happy, even. Had I ever before seen Shade content and happy? I moved toward him, and he embraced me more warmly. Or did the skill seize me? Where did Shade stop and the skill begin? Had he already drowned in the skill? Was he dragging me down to join him?
Shade! Shade, Falstar, come back to us! Dutiful, help me! He's fighting me!
Nettle gripped him and attempted to peel him away from me. I held to him fiercely, struggling to make her aware of me, but she was focused on separating us.
Nettle!
I roared my thought, trying to make it stand out from the rip and rush of thoughts around us. Thoughts? No, not thoughts. Being. Beings. I pushed all wondering aside. Instead of clinging to Shade, I thrust him toward her.
I've got him!
She told a dutiful I barely sensed, and then in sudden awe,
Da, are you here? Are you alive?
Yes, we are all fine. We'll send you a bird from Bingtown. Then, divorced from Shade, the surge of the skill began to tear at me. I tried to draw back, but the skill gripped me like a bog. As I struggled, it sucked at me, pulling me deeper. Beings. The current was a flow of beings, all plucking at me. I gathered my strength and flung myself against its current as I resolutely put up my walls. I opened my eyes to the blessedly cramped and smelly little cabin. I folded forward over my knees, gasping and shaking.
What?
The fool demanded. I nearly lost myself. Shade was there. He tried to pull me in with him.
What?
He told me that everything I learned about the skill was wrong. That I should give myself over to the skill. Just let go, he said. And I nearly did. I nearly let go. His gloved hand closed on my shoulder and shook me lightly.
Fitz, I did not think you had even begun to try. I told you to stop agonizing about it, and you fell silent. I thought you were sulking.
He cocked his head.
Only moments have passed since we last spoke.
Only moments? I rested my forehead on my knees. I felt sick with fear and dazed with longing. It had been so easy. I could drop my walls and be gone. Just gone. I'd merge with those other rushing entities and wash away. My hopeless quest would be abandoned, along with the loss I felt whenever I thought of B. Gone would be the deep shame, gone the humiliation that everyone knew how badly I had failed as a father. I could stop feeling and thinking.
Don't go,
the fool said softly.
What?
I sat up slowly. His grip tightened slowly on my shoulder.
Don't go where I can't follow you. Don't leave me behind. I'd still have to go on. I'd still have to return to Clarice and try to kill them all. Even though I would fail. Even though they would have me in their power again.
He let go of me and crossed his arms as if to contain himself. I wasn't aware of the connection I'd felt from his touch until he removed it.
Someday we must part. It's inevitable. One of us will have to go on without the other. We both know that. But Fitz, please, not yet. Not until after this hard thing is done.
I won't leave you. I wondered if I lied. I'd tried to leave him. This insane mission would be easier if I were working alone. probably still impossible, but my failure would be less horrific, less shameful to me. He was silent for a time, looking into the distance. His voice was hard and desperate as he demanded,
"Promise me."
"What?"
"Promise me that you won't give in to Shade's lure. That I won't find you somewhere sitting like an empty sack with your mind gone. Promise me you won't try to abandon me like useless baggage. That you won't leave me behind so I'm safe, out of your way."
I reached for the right words, but it took me too long to find them. He did not hide his hurt and bitterness as he said,
"You can't, can you? Very well. At least I know my standing. Well, my old friend, here is something I can promise you. No matter what you do, Fitz, no matter if you stand or fall, run or die, I must go back to Clarice and do my best to pull it all down around their ears. As I told you before, with you or without you."
I made a final effort. "Fool, you know I am the best man for this task. I know that I work best alone. You should let me do this my way." He was motionless. Then he asked,
"If I said that to you, and if it were true, would you allow me to go alone into that place? Would you sit idly by and wait for me to rescue B?"
An easy lie. "I would," I said heartily. He said nothing. Did he know I lied? Probably. But we had to recognize what was real. He could not do this. His shaking terror had created serious doubt in me. If he succumbed to it in Clarice, I simply could not take him. I knew his threat was real. He would find his way there, with or without me. But if I could get there before him and do my task, if the deed was done, he'd have no quest. But would he ever forgive me? While I'd been silent, he'd stored the pouch of elf bark in his pack. He sipped from his cup.
"My tea's gone cold,"
he announced. He stood, cup and saucer in hand. He smoothed his hair and flounced his skirts into order, and the fool was gone. Amber trailed her fingers along the wall until she found the door and then left me sitting alone on the narrow bunk. The fool and I had one serious quarrel on that journey. I came to Amber's cabin one evening at our agreed-upon time as Spark was leaving. Her face was pale and strained, and she gave me a tragic look as she left. I wondered if Amber had rebuked her. I dreaded finding him in a dark and irrational mood. Slowly, I closed the door behind me. Inside the room, yellow candles burned in glass, and the fool perched on the lower bunk. His grey woolen nightrobe had seen much wear, probably purloined from Shade's clothing stash. The shadows under his eyes and the resigned droop of his mouth made him older. I sat down on the bunk opposite him and waited. Then I saw my hastily stitched pack beside him. "What's that doing here?" I asked. For one moment, I thought that some accident had brought it to his room. He set a possessive hand on it and spoke hoarsely.
"I have promised to take all blame for this. Even so, I fear I may have broken Spark's friendship to do this. She brought it to me."
Cold spread out of my belly and through my veins. I made a conscious and difficult choice. No anger. Fury surged against my willful blocking. I knew, but still I asked. "And why would you ask her to do that?"
"Because Perseverance mentioned to her that you had books that belonged to B. Sometimes he saw you read what she had written there. Two books, one with a bright embossed cover and the other plain. He recognized her hand on the page when he climbed past you to his bunk."
He paused. I shivered with fear of how angry I might become. I controlled my breath, as Shade had taught me, the silent breathing of an assassin on the verge of a kill. I quenched my emotions. The violation I felt was too immense. The fool spoke softly.
"I think she kept a dream journal. If she is mine, if she carries the blood of a white, then she will dream. The drive to share those dreams, to speak or write them, would be overpowering. She will have done it. Fitz, you are